Blog Talk Radio.
We have of Suspense Radio Inside Edition. This is September the 5th, 2015. We want to thank you all, however, wherever, whenever you listen to the show. It's always great to have you on. We have three fantastic authors for you today. We are going to be kicking it off with author R.J. Dearden calling us all the way from the U.K., talking about his book, The Realignment Case, followed up by author Sheffy Stevens, who's out with her latest book called Those Girls. And we're going to finish it with author Megan Beaumont, and she's going to be talking about her book, Promises to Keep. So without any further ado, let's get to it right now, and let's bring on our first guest. R.J. Dearden is our guest here, and The Realignment Case is his first book. So, R.J., thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Doing really well. Thank you, John. Thanks for having me. There's about 5,500 miles between us, but the line's great.
Isn't this beautiful, though? There is. There's about that much time, but we seem so close, and it's like we're in the same room together.
Exactly. So I suppose I can tell you a little bit what the realignment case is all about.
Let's get into the realignment case, and let's see what you got going on.
Okay, so the realignment case is a thriller with a sci-fi underbelly, or perhaps a sci-fi with a thriller underbelly, thriller pacing. It's merged into a philosophical argument about time manipulation. So it's set in 2012. It's set in pretty much the here and now, but there is a sort of leap of imagination. You have to work with me and believe that there is a machine that exists in total secrecy, a machine that can change the past. And so the story, the protagonist is a young lawyer called Daniel Athley. He's in disgrace at the start of the novel, and he takes a job in Geneva, which is in Switzerland, without really knowing what he signed up for. And he begins working for a very enigmatic character, somebody called Counselor Winter, and he discovers that the business that he's working for, something called the Department, has a powerful machine that can change the past. And that's pretty much the core of the novel. It starts with it's kind of the opposite of a whodunit. It starts with a crime, very violent crime, and it's pretty clear who done it. And the reason why it's the opposite of a whodunit, because the rest of the novel is very much about, are they going to undo this crime because they have the ability to?
So that's a little different spin on it. So you're saying, at the beginning of the book, there's a violent crime that takes place, and the reader is knowing what's going on, but the character might not know what's going on. So you're following that retrospective. Okay, is Daniel going to be able to figure out? But the criminals have the ability to undo what they've done?
Well, the criminal's been tried. He's been convicted. He's a very nasty, nasty piece of work called Victor. And he's murdered a brilliant geneticist, Professor Lillian Pascura. And he's been convicted and tried in the British courts and sentenced to life in prison. And the department spirits him out of the UK on a false pretense. And he's actually present. He's manacled during this sort of trial. It's not a trial about guilt. It's really a trial about whether the murdered victim is going to get a second chance at living. So it's not a dry courtroom drama. The pace at the start, so it starts with this violent murder, and then basically the reader learns with Dan. He's at times he can be a bit prickly, But the reader, very much the reader is learning with.
Gotcha. Okay, now let's just get into Dan here. Let's just get into your main character and figure out, because now I understand that kind of the science fiction aspect of what you were talking about. And yeah, like you said, this is not a courtroom drama book. This is, you know, this is going to be more along the lines of a, you know, of a thriller that's going to be more fast paced. Where then does Dan fit in? Why is he the one that you felt would be perfect to be the lead of this story? Oh, and I think I have lost RJ. But you know what? That's what we might do here in the UK. You'll have to call, don't forget to give us a call back on the line. But let me tell you first, too, to find out more information, you want to go to rjdearden.com, and that's DEARDEN.com for more information on the book, The Realignment Case. And while we wait for him to call in, I will also let you know that this is being Suspense Radio is being brought to you. Oh, and we don't have to worry about that because we got him back on the phone here. So, hey, we lost you, but that's okay. We got you back, RJ. How you doing?
Good. 5,500 miles, I suppose, is going to happen. Hopefully not too much.
Yeah. Let's hope that's the only time that happens. But, okay, so my question was real quick, and I don't know how much of it you heard, so I'll just repeat it again, is now that we kind of understand what you, you know, the science fiction kind of aspect that you were talking about in that, and it's, I wanted to talk more kind of about Daniel here, and I want you to kind of let us know, why did you feel he was the perfect one to be the front man of your book, and who is he?
Daniel, the reason why I picked Daniel is because I deliberately made him a bit hot-tempered. He has an anger issue, which makes him act before he thinks. And that's great for a character because when they start living and breathing and being real characters when you're writing them, the ones with the hot tempers are the ones that are always rushing off and doing stuff. And that's why I picked Daniel. His situation is that he's out of work. He's got a young wife who's pregnant, and he has to go along with everything that he discovers, and working for Councillor Winter. So Dan is a really solid character. He's a really good describer. At times I find him a bit prickly. I know some readers do, but he has a good heart. And he wants to do the right thing. And that's important because in the novel, Dan actually finds himself, he's one of the bad guys. Councillor Winter, his job is to, he's basically play devil's advocate and run down the poor geneticist that was murdered at the start. And so Dan finds himself, he has to support this role where they are constantly running her down and making out that she's a terrible person. And he doesn't like that. He finds himself, it challenges his ethics. So once you start challenging what your characters stand for, then they start behaving in unusual ways.
So he's torn. There's some kind of, he's torn in trying to figure certain things out and kind of maybe who he is. Is he trying to discover himself, maybe who he is? Because he's been put into the situation that he's not used to being put into, would you say that, he kind of gets more emotional as the book goes on, as things start to more, unravel themselves?
Well, he does, because the sci-fi element, there's something called the Cassie machine. So the Cassie machine is a total secret, and Dan doesn't believe in it to begin with. And then during the trial, he actually sees, because it can actually pull past events out and replay them on the courtroom floor. So it's not like it's not dry and lots of dialogue, long sort of speeches. There's actually past events that are replayed in stunning detail. And Dan discovers that he at times he has a weak stomach, and some of the things that he sees from the past shock him. And he's constantly being pulled because his mentor, Councillor Winter, who is, for me, the most fun character in the novel is, and comes out as many people's favourite. He's on such a long winning streak. He is top dog. He is absolutely making mincemeat of the opposition, and the opposition see Dan as the weak link, and they go for him all the time to try and undermine the status quo. I call it contra change, the team against change.
Interesting. So, and that was going to be the question was, I was going to kind of ask you a little bit later here, which kind of character did you feel maybe had a bigger voice in the story than you originally thought that they were going to do as you were conceptualizing the story? Would that be the counselor that you're talking about?
Counselor, yeah, Winter, absolutely.
Yeah.
Winter is a character I've had bouncing around my head for many years, and I was always trying to find the right story for Winter. And then I put him in this role where he's the devil's advocate, and he came into his own. He's classically flawed in the sense that he's charming, but he says very rude things. He's honourable, but he will do anything to win. And in some respects, if he's in a scene, he steals that scene. And it's the friendship and the tension between Dan and Winter. Is definitely something that drives the novel forward.
And now, where did the idea come, I guess, for this machine? What was this? Was this something else that, you know, was there maybe like another book, or was there maybe a movie, something that kind of turned you on to where you wanted to maybe explore this further for yourself?
That's a really good question, John. It's set in Geneva, and the reason why it's set in Geneva is because it's a place that I've been to a lot. It's in Switzerland. It's a French-speaking part of Switzerland. There's lots of, you know, organisations in Geneva. The UN being one of those big organisations. Its sister site in New York. And I had a friend there who was installing some air conditioning, and he took me on a sort of unofficial guided tour around the UN, and we sort of. It would access all areas, and so we went into the rooms with all the name tags, and I changed who was on the Permanent Security Council, and then we listened in on some hush meetings, and he told me a lot of gossip about what some ambassadors put in their diplomatic pouches, and it was really interesting, and I just started to think, well, what would happen if I invented my own secret organization? And there's loads of scientists in Geneva, because, you know, I assume you've heard of CERN, where they're looking for the Higgs boson and particle, all that particle bashing that they do. And I started thinking, well, what happens if you've got something like the UN, and it means the best, it's got the best of intentions, something like the CERN with all these brilliant scientists, and then something like FIFA, you know, the soccer federation, which is based in Switzerland, which is, for want of a better phrase, quite commonly known as corrupt. And if you merged all those in together, you've got this department. And then once I'd sort of thought of this department, suddenly, you know, them having a machine that they'd keep quiet, they'd do anything to, you know, they'd kill to stop people finding out they're a secret organization. And there's a lot of secrecy in Switzerland. And then it all started to come together. And then I moved the characters into this milieu. And you know, that's where the story really came from.
Huh. Yeah, there's so much secretive that goes on behind the scenes in those areas that I think that if the public actually maybe knew, we would probably set ourselves into a panic. So I think it's wonderful that, you know, authors are able to kind of bring some of that out in a fictional setting, but could very well be true.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, Geneva's, you know, it's full of pretty girls. You know, I married one. It's got these secret organizations. They say there's loads of art, of World War II art looted, still in the vaults in Geneva. There's a lot of secrets, a lot of money flowing around.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sort of exciting because where there's money, well, there's corruption.
That's true.
I'm not saying the whole of Geneva is.
Yeah.
But in the fictional minds of R.J. Dearden, that's where it starts to sort of juice up.
Now, the other thing I like to talk about is kind of your journey, because this is your first kind of thriller book. This is the first one that you come out with. And the journey to try to get this thing published and launched, I'm always curious to see, because, you know, and I'm sure it's kind of the same way in the United States as it is in the UK. I mean, people looking for agents, or now you can go almost straight to publishers and try to get it done. So how was your journey? How were you able to kind of, you know, get this thing going and finally get the book out?
So I work full time. I work in IT, and I wrote the book on the trains up to London a lot. So once I've got it into a state where it's an acceptable manuscript, and it's never really finished, that's what I discovered, but I was happy I started submitting it. The big publishing houses in the UK, they do want you to have an agent, then, you know, and that's their filtering process. And when you're an unknown, like, you know, I was, it's very hard to get in that door. I was very fortunate to find quite a small publishing house. I mean, they do have a global reach, but they haven't got a massive marketing department, who were willing to take a chance on me. And that was John Hunt Publishing, and I'm under their Round Fire imprint. But yeah, I mean, a lot of rejection, a lot of schoolboy errors on my behalf when I sent stuff off the attachment, wrong attachment, those sorts of things. And you live and learn. And I learned a lot.
I feel so bad because, you know, we're a publisher and we have suspense publishing, and I feel so bad when people sit there and they do those kinds of things. And it's like, oh, I can't believe that, you know, you sent this over or that over. I mean, and I always look at that as kind of nerves mistake. I don't really look down upon that. The only thing that I do kind of frown upon is when you're writing a query letter and it's maybe not have very good grammar, misspellings. It's like, okay, that was, you know, you could have taken more time in that. I understand if you attached the wrong file. But I do understand kind of the nerves and kind of trying to get yourself out. And when you finally are able to be published, and now that you're out and now that you're talking about it, you're being interviewed, and not many people in the United States, I think we talked offline, this is what, am I the first one in the U.S. to really kind of interview you about the book?
Yes, absolutely, John. You're the first, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity.
So the question is, what kind of myths were debunked for you when you got into the publishing? Things maybe you heard from other people, but now that you're into it, you're like, oh, I had no idea this really went on, or this is how it worked. What are those things that happened for you?
Well, what I've discovered is, obviously, once you've broken into the world, then you are treated slightly differently. Agents don't look at you with these sort of nervous eyes, as if you're desperately thrusting a manuscript onto them, saying it's going to be the next best thing. Once you've sort of made it over that initial, you know, bridge, that then they're more willing to talk to you, and that's what I've discovered. As I've also discovered, there's a hell of a lot of competition out there. There's a massive amount of great writing, and readers, bless them, can only read so fast. So it's slower. It's a slower take up. People I know that have bought the book, they put a review up about 6 months later. So people read slowly and at their own pace. But that's kind of what I've learned.
Yeah, that's for sure. And which is kind of actually interesting, because with social media being so prevalent and it's in everybody's lives now, and, you know, I was hoping it was going to go away, but I guess I'm wrong, is now everything is so instant. So somebody can read the book and all of a sudden they can post something up and you can see it right away. And before, you know, 20 years ago, you didn't have to do that. You didn't really know what the public was thinking until maybe 6 or 8 months later, when you started seeing sales or other stuff like that. And maybe they're like, oh, yeah, it starts, you know, your book's flying off the shelves now, but you really had no idea. But now you can track that. So when you look at your social media and you kind of see the instantaneous thing, do you kind of make it think for the next book, you know what, I had no idea they were interested in that, and maybe I'll focus more on this type of writing in the next thing? Or are you just going to write what you're going to write regardless of what people say?
That's very perceptive. I've actually joined a few Facebook groups since I got published, real, you know, big book clubs with, you know, 3,000-4,000 members. There's epilogues, there's the book club, and it's fascinating for an author to actually have a window in on what people like. I'm definitely, my ear is more attuned. I'm from what I'm seeing on social media, the female readership, you know, of these groups, it's 95% to 5% male, and you know, that's interesting. And the things that you know, the stories that they like, and I am tapping into. But fundamentally, I can only write R.J. Dearden style, and there definitely is an R.J. Dearden style. So my current project is sci-fi dystopia set in 2065. But I'm taking on board a lot of what I'm hearing in these on social media. It'd be wrong not to.
Yeah, and when you see social media, because in the UK and in the United States, you kind of you kind of see what the U.S. readers are interested in, you know what the U.K. readers are. How do you see differences? What differences do you see between the two continents and the two areas, just readers in general, about what they talk about?
Do you know what? I don't really see a lot of difference, and it's only very small traits that I see on social media that actually, you know, it dawns on me that someone is actually in the middle of Texas or somewhere else. There is a lot more in common, especially I think, between the UK audience and an American audience than there is not in common. That's definitely something that, you know, I've learned from being attached on social media, when you pick up, you know, followers and friends from all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I have to ask, because I'm a fan, and I know a lot of people, and I'm a huge sports fan, and I do watch the Premier League. So who do you follow?
Well, I follow a team called Sheffield United, who have been in the Premier League. They've dropped down a couple of divisions. If I had to support a Premier League side at the moment, it would be Arsenal. I've always enjoyed going up to Highbury. Are you a fan of any of the Premier League teams?
I do like Arsenal because I'm a huge Ozil fan, and I do like Ozil because I follow the German national team, and Bayern Munich, I look at the Bundesliga, and I love Bayern Munich. But my team in the Premier League, which I actually have their sweatshirt on right now while I'm interviewing, is Tottenham.
Well, Spurs are a good team, but you know, I mean, I unconsciously picked North London rivals, so Spurs and Arsenal are the big rivals.
Yeah, and I love the interaction, and I love the interaction, and you can see just in sports in general how it's different from the UK to America, and that's why I always kind of ask the question, you know, with the readers, how they're kind of different, because it is a much different crowd when you're looking at in the sports aspect, and you probably have seen, you know, it's just a little different. It's different how we do sports to how you do sports, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are now starting to follow the MLS. You know, players like Beckham,
wow, really?
Gerrard, and Lampard. You know, people will say, you know, this is my favorite MLS team. The attitudes, I mean, of course, I mean, you know, we do play slightly different sports. You know, football, you know, soccer is something that, you know, I know is coming up in America, but you know, I've always enjoyed watching baseball matches as well.
Oh, well, yeah, baseball is one of my top sports. I mean, of course, I'm a huge Dodger fan. And I do follow the Galaxy. I do like the Galaxy. We go to about one game a year because it's a little farther away. It's a little past L.A. where the actual stadium is. So it's about an hour and a half drive. And then through L.A. traffic, you just never know how far that's going to be. But, yeah, we do like to go see the Galaxy, and I do like to go do that. Soccer, to me, is a sport that it's so much fun because it is kind of like a book. Because you have the thriller aspect with the suspense aspect and the mystery part of it. And part of it, because there's no commercials. It just runs all the way through. You got a little 15-minute break, and then you keep running again. Whereas the other sports, with baseball, every half inning there's a commercial. But, you know, American football, when the ball turns over, there's a commercial. There's a lot more slowness to it. And soccer seems to be the quickest paced sport.
Yeah, I mean, and my favourite thing about soccer is that on any day, 11 men can stand up against another 11 men, and you get some real upsets.
Yeah.
I mean, the US did brilliantly in the World Cup. We were all cheering for them, and they just kept on going and surprised a hell of a lot of people.
Exactly.
And that's the excitement, you know, the exciting fact that, you know, 11 superstars can have an off day and 11 average players can play out of their skins. And, that's a recipe for an upset.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so happy Germany won. And I also want to let you know that we got about 30 seconds left. And I want to give you the last word to kind of let everybody know where they can find you, your social media, your website, all that fun stuff.
Okay, so the realignment case, it's selling on Amazon.com. It's Walmart, Barnes & Noble. It's a great time to buy a copy. It's been slightly discounted, so get in there. Social media, I'm on Facebook under RJ Dearden. And I have a website, www.rjdearden.com. Needs a little bit of work, I confess. But that's me in a nutshell.
That's it. Hey, RJ, we want to thank you so much for calling in. It's been fabulous to talk to you. Have fun over there in the UK. Try to stay warm, and we will talk with you soon.
Thank you very much, John. Appreciate the time.
All right. Bye-bye. So, anyway, that is author RJ Dearden. The book is The Realignment Case. Check it out now. Go to Amazon and view it, rjdearden.com. You can have the link right there. Also, I'll let you know that this show today is brought to you by New American Library, publisher of Somebody I Used to Know. It's the latest thriller from author David Bell, who Nelson DeMille praised as a natural storyteller and superb writer. And here at Suspense Magazine, we said David Bell is one of the brightest and the best crime writer fiction of our time, or fiction writers of our time. So check out Somebody I Used to Know by David Bell. And we are going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest, author Chevy Stevens. It's great to have her back on. It's been about a year and a half, I think, since we have her on to talk about her latest book, Those Girls. And this is going to be exciting. So in the meantime, give us about 3 minutes.
You hear
Welcome back, everybody, after the break. Again, we want to thank R.J. Dearden for being on and talking about his book, The Realignment Case. But now we're going to shift gears, and we are going to jump into author Chevy Stevens. She broke out big time with her first book, Still Missing. I can't believe that she's already on book five. We just talked about that, that time has been kind of going fast. And now she's in with her latest book that came out July 7th called Those Girls. So we want to welcome Chevy back to the show. So, Chevy, thanks so much. How you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me again.
Yes. And like we just said, Those Girls, your books are very emotionally driven. I mean, from Still Missing, I mean, you got to, when you came out of the gate with that one, I mean, that hit really, really hard. And kind of, it almost was a precursor of kind of how things happened. I mean, you had the Cleveland stuff that went on and some of these other kind of bizarre cases. And so your books are very emotionally driven. So give us the behind-the-scenes look into Those Girls and kind of what you have in store for the readers this time.
Those Girls is about three sisters. This time around, I wanted to write a little bit more about some characters who are very bonded and show what can happen in a scenario. In this case, these girls grow up in a very difficult childhood. They have an abusive father. Something happens one night, and they are forced to go on the run. And while they're on the run, they run into some very bad people in a small town and are forced into a situation where they can't go to your normal help because of a crime that they have committed. So I sort of wanted to put a box around them, put them in a very tough situation, and they can't get the same help, and then show how their love and loyalty holds them through that. And then the second half of the book takes place many years later when one of them has a daughter who is beginning to find out her mother and her aunt's secret. So for me, it was I wanted to do a sort of an Outsiders meets Thelma Louise meets The Deliverance kind of vibe, and I just really wanted to experiment with love and loyalty and see what came out of that. All my other characters have been very solitary characters, so it was a new challenge for me.
And that's what I was going to ask, because it was kind of a new thing, and you like to, like any author, you like to explore your inner self and you know, can you do certain things and your kind of writing. So when you decided that this is what you were going to write, was there a certain aspect of your writing that you really wanted to kind of focus on, whether it was the emotional part, whether it was, like you said, just having these three sisters and how these things are going? Was there a conscious effort in one particular part of your writing that you wanted to get into the book?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to, as I said, explore their relationship. Also, I wanted to experiment with really creating setting. I set this in the summer. I started in the summer, so it was very easy to me think in those hot terms. I wanted to use that. I really leaned on the heat in the book. I wanted to give it lots of atmosphere and lots of flavor, you know, girls and jean shorts and hot summer days and pickup trucks. I just wanted that all in there. Small, creepy towns, you know, I just really wanted to create that feeling. And then also, big fear. My challenge with this book was to really, really have that lingering sense of terror, because it seems that, you know, most of my readers really want that. They want the emotions, and I think that's what sets my books, you know, it's not your typical thriller, because there is love, there is feeling, there is deep, deep, deep emotion and psychological issues and family dysfunction, but also a really terrifying scenario, and then see how these girls would manage to pull themselves out and how it would affect each of them differently. Not everyone is going to respond the exact same way to a trauma.
Right. That's the other thing. When you're talking, you have three sisters like that. You know, one of them might run from a situation. One of them might go to a situation, or one of them might help in a situation. You just don't
exactly
know what's going to do. And so when you were
exactly
exploring that, what surprises happened for you with each of the sisters? What kind of surprised you with each of them, how they were able to kind of tackle the certain situations that you thrust upon them?
I'm not sure I had specific surprises, because it's usually conscious for me. I have a friend who's a therapist, so normally I will sit down and, you know, I'll work through a scenario with her, and we will really discuss what type of personality types, who, how different people will respond to a scenario. I knew very early on that I wanted one of the sisters to still be struggling with it, and that she was never going to fully recover, because, of course, in real life, that is the case. You know, there is often people who just can't get over their trauma. And show the, you know, the younger one is the dreamer. And I really just needed to work on each of their specific qualities and how that would magnify in these scenarios.
Well, let's kind of get into them. So, you know, so their names are, you know, Jess, Courtney, and Danny, and they're the three Campbell sisters. So let's just get into it. Let's just talk about Jess for a second. Who is Jess Campbell?
Jess is the youngest sister. At the opening of the book, she is the younger one. She is the dreamer. She's a good girl. She wants to be a photographer. The middle sister is Courtney, and she is the beautiful wild child who wants to be a country singer and is often messing around with boys that she shouldn't be. And then Danny, also known as Danielle, is the oldest sister. She, of course, is your reliable, responsible one who takes care of them, who has a long-term boyfriend, is always trying to do the right thing, but also feels the burden of being responsible for her siblings, of course.
Mm. So you kind of got, you got the melting pot mixture of all three different personalities. And what you got on this one.
And they're all three are also very strong girls. You know, there's not, you know, they're all very feisty. They're survivors. They've, you know, they've been living on their own. They're all deeply loyal. They take care of each other. They argue amongst themselves, but they're definitely all on the same team.
And when you're talking about the antagonist in the book, or and it could be, you know, and it might just be all the situations and things that you got going on. When you were sitting and creating that kind of a character and that situation, is it difficult because it kind of sometimes is a dark subject and your books do go into a, like you said, very psychological, very emotional that they happen. Is it sometimes difficult for you to push yourself there because that's not the type of person that you are?
Yeah, it is. You know, the father, he wasn't, He just kind of came naturally out of that scenario. I think we all know evil people, like, or not evil, abusive drunks, you know. He was easier to get into his mindset of controlling his daughters. The men that they run into, that was difficult, of course, because you have to think, you know, who would do this and why would they do it and everything. You know, what was their gain? And it's hard not to fall into cliches. It's hard, you know, you have to try to stretch yourself to always think outside of the box. And I'm especially finding this with the book that I'm actually currently working on, which is called Not Alone. In this one, I have an abusive husband, but I'm trying to do it in a I'm trying to experiment with fear and show how somebody can control somebody without overt violence. Which, again, really stretches myself because I don't think like a manipulative, abusive husband. That's not how my mind goes. So, you know, it is completely opposite of my relationship. You know, I don't think, gee, how can I terrify my husband into staying with me? So I'm certainly having to stretch myself because, yeah, you know, you're being somebody that's just unfathomable to you. So,
yeah.
And making it believable.
And there's that great show on the ID Discovery Channel called Deadly Women that I was actually watching a little last night, and it's how women, you know, do their things to try to keep men with them or whatever their, you know, whatever their problems are. And it always scares me. It's like, you just don't think about that. You think that that's more of a man thing, but, you know, women do have that capability.
They just have different motivations usually, I think, which in that case it sounds like it is typically like relationship-based. It's not usually like, whereas a lot of the crimes against women that are committed by men are usually sexually oriented. Not always, of course, there's abusive husbands, et cetera, but it's often about, you know, sexual crimes. Whereas women, it's more about relationship, you know, trying to keep their husband or revenge maybe, or they feel rejected and this is how they will make you pay.
Yeah. Now, is there a subject that you will not touch as an author? Is there just one that you said, you know what, I'm not going to get involved in that?
Yeah, children. Now that I have children, now that I have my own daughter, I just couldn't fathom writing anything again about a child being abducted or taken or anything going horrible with her. I just couldn't. It just makes me sick to even talk about it.
Yeah,
and I think
It's like bringing bad energy into your world. I just can't do it.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of authors think that children and, of course, animals are one of the two things that they kind of, you know, stay away from. It's like, you know, never kill a child and never kill a dog because you are going to get hate mail forever.
Yeah.
And I think that
did have a dog. Something happened, not violently, or, you know, I had to be very careful how I did it. You know, and I had somebody email me and took me to task for that, and yet there was lots of horrific things that happened to people in this book, but I got
the
letter about the dog.
So yes.
Apparently the other stuff was okay. But yeah, and I am a huge animal lover, so I'm extremely careful with that because myself, you know.
Yeah, you can damage all the teenage and up people that you really want to damage, but you mess with dogs. And that's it.
Yeah.
You're going to hear it for a long time.
Even though I did it very peacefully, you know, there was no, you know, I did it like very as sensitive as I possibly could, but yeah.
Uh-huh. And now that this is your fifth book, and you've kind of been involved in the publishing now for quite some time, and now you've kind of seen how things kind of work. What is kind of the one thing that, you know, you've been able to kind of maneuver and manipulate yourself through now, through five books? And how have things changed from the beginning of when you first started out?
I'm not sure I understand the question 100%.
Well, I mean, from the first book when you first came out, I mean, everybody was all bright-eyed and you really, really know, you know, what to expect and what was going on. But now that you've been in it for some time, how has it changed for you from the beginning? How have things kind of changed? Have you done anything different as far as, you know, maybe it's just maybe marketing or writing for the audience or seeing what the audience likes and those types of things?
Yeah, I think there's a greater awareness. My publishers have treated me the same all the way along. They've always been awesome. There's always been lots of support. That's always the same. I think I'm certainly more aware, whereas when you're writing your book, your first book, you have no... It was more about my craft, really, that is, I feel I'm more conscious of and more, you know, trying to stretch and grow all the time. Not so much about the... You know, marketing is what it is. You have a website, you do Twitter, you do social media. You know, most of it's publish-oriented or my publishers. And, you know, they've been always really great about sending out early copies and doing things like that. I've just been more aware of always trying to stretch myself. I know I find readers are generally harder on, obviously, additional books than your first book. There seems to be, everyone wants something different always, so that can be a challenge. So it's just really just trying to personally grow and learn and tap in and make each one my best one and figuring out my audience, you know, what they want, what they don't want from me, you know.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Chevy Stevens, and you can go to ChevyStevens.com for more information on her latest book called Those Girls, and of course, all the other four that you have starting back were Still Missing, and That Night was your last one after this. And why have you not come into the fold? And I want to applaud you, first of all, for not doing it, because I'm a standalone reader guy. I'm not a big series guy. So why have you decided not to go that route? Why are you staying in the standalone era when so many people are now writing series?
It hasn't had a super conscious decision. Honestly, my first three are actually linked because there's The Therapist Who Doesn't Speak and Still Missing, and then in Never Knowing She Also Doesn't Speak, and then the third book is her story. So although you can read them all separately and they are standalones, they are also sort of somewhat linked. And then it's been standalone since then. It's just the way that the stories have come to me. Sometimes I think about pulling a certain character out of some of these books and then taking forward with their story. The other thing is my agent doesn't particularly want me to write a series because it makes it really difficult if you ever want to sell movie rights or TV rights. If you sell one, they have the right to, they have first option on anything, that character in for 7 years. So that really tangles you up that way. And it can be limited. And really, series characters only work if you have detectives, usually, or one particular type character like that. And I don't write police procedures. So, you know, usually so much has happened to my characters. I just don't fathom. I couldn't see putting that same person through anything again. The only way I would do it is maybe to pluck one character from the book and then create a separate story for them.
It's, I gotcha, yeah. I mean, and I think, and like I said, I applaud because I like the fact knowing that every time that you're sitting down, like you're doing right now in your next book, that you had to look in front of a blank canvas and you really had, you know, you had to start from scratch again. You didn't really have some things filled in. And it kind of makes you have to think. And I think that that's, and I think that that makes you grow more as an author because you're continually pushing yourself because you have to keep doing that with standalone books a lot more. That's
you're recreating world, you're recreating people, family, characters, everything, and finding new ways. And you go, oh, yeah, no, I already had a dad like that. Okay, I got to, you know, it definitely forces you to do more. I do think sometimes, wow, if I could just take so-and-so, we already know what she's all about. I've already made her. You know, I could just deepen her. But there can be issues with that, you know. If you have, I know for people who write series, they are just as difficult. They just have a different sort of difficulty, I think. They have to have that same character have, you know, growth throughout every book that they, you know, have. Honestly, I have thought sometimes I would like to write a detective book and write a series because I like them personally. Like, I like watching those kind of shows. But other than doing an RCMP officer or a police know how I would do it, private investigators just aren't really a big thing on Vancouver Island. So I just don't see where it could go.
And you just like to screw with people's minds. I like that. I think that that's wonderful.
Yeah, pretty much.
I like the psychological.
Well, it's finding new
part.
Ways. Yeah, it's finding new ways. Like the book I'm working on right now. You know, I didn't want to. Although I've become known for it, and it's sometimes what I think my readers want from me. You know, violence, and it's not necessarily what I'm like. Oh, I want to write some more horrible things. You know, I'm exploring what scares me. But what's the challenge with this book is to not have overt violence, you know, to find a way to be scared, to be tense, to be feel all those frightening feelings throughout a book without there being actual violence on every page. So that's been new, and that's I'm enjoying that challenge. It's more of a psychological manipulation.
Right. And I think trying to get involved in the heads of your character gets involved in the heads of your readers, and it's kind of like a thinking person. I mean, it makes you really kind of think about, you know, about the characters, and it gives them more depth and creation. It makes people either love them or hate them, and I always feel, regardless of if you get emails or letters saying, oh, my God, I hated that character, and I can't believe that you did that to that character or whatever, and I wish they would die. You know what? You still did your job because you made the reader make an emotional decision, and I think that that's all you can really do in the end.
And my goal always, I mean, I'm always trying to express things that are important to me. I think that's the main thing. If you can't access, and, you know, my editor is an amazing editor, and she always knows when I am feeling the story on a personal level and when I'm not. And so I'm learning to be very mindful of that as I go through myself. Am I writing a story or am I feeling the story? And I have to be feeling the story. And this book is very much, again, about survivors. It's about a mother and daughter. I have a daughter myself, and it's actually interesting, like two or three of my books had daughters in them before I had my own daughter. So I really want to explore that. And also, you know, I think this is something that's very men and women, as anybody who's in an abusive, controlling relationship will identify with just how insidious it is and how hard it is to get out of these scenarios. And, you know, to feel controlled is an awful, horrible feeling, so...
Now, are you doing? Did you do any like book tours? Did you go out and do a lot of book signings, or was it a lot of it online and virtual for this latest?
For
book?
Those girls, I didn't. I only did a local one. I did a lot for that night. I went down in the States and I traveled for about a week. Most nowadays, honestly, it's virtual. You know, you just don't need to do that.
Yeah.
It's also difficult because I live up in Canada. I live on Vancouver Island. It's not like I live in a very metropolitan area where it's just a plane here, a plane there, a plane somewhere else. It's a really long haul for me to get down there and then to be away from my family for a long time. And I have a young daughter. She's only 2.5. And it's just not, it doesn't equate dollar-wise to make it effort for anybody nowadays. I interact a lot with my fans on Facebook. I think that's, you know, the bigger way. I am going to Germany this fall. I will be doing some events in Germany.
Really?
But I try to pick only like one. Yeah, I'm really excited about that. I have wonderful German publishers, and we're going there for 2 weeks. I do have some family there as well. My dad was born in Berlin, so we're going as a family. We'll be doing some personal things and then spending some time touring Frankfurt, Berlin, Munich. So that'll be thrilling.
And now you see how closely linked we are, because family is from Leipzig, and then they're also from Munich, and so I'm a very German person.
Yeah.
And German readers and European readers, like I just had R.J. Dearden on, and Peter James is a good friend of mine, Mark Bellingham, Ian Ranking, and so I know a lot of European authors, and it's funny to see the translation from European to American and back and forth, and like I just said, I think it's great. It's easier for American authors to become more popular in Europe than vice versa. So it's wonderful that you get to go out there to Germany.
Yeah, well, I'm Canadian, of course, but the Germans love Canada.
Well, I mean,
Canada,
the North American, North America.
Yeah.
Seems to be different.
Yeah, the Germans very much love Canadian exactly. It does seem to be like they embrace us. Like That Night was number 10 on their bestseller list. Like it actually hit higher in Germany than it did in the States, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
I'm a bigger hit over there. I would say I'm like a rock
there
star in Germany. But they're very embracing of our type of writing for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's great, because it's just good to be so global and that your stories are able to see, such a global amount of people, and to kind of see how different reactions happen between different, groups in different countries. I think that it's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's exciting for me. I mean, I live on a small island on, on Canada, or in Canada, where do I live? I live on Vancouver Island on the coast of Canada, and, a lot of people around the world and in the States don't actually even know where Vancouver Island is, so it's kind of fun for me to write about it and share it with the world, and everyone typically Canadians get told frequently not to set their books in Canada, too, that they will not hit success if they're set in Canada, and I've managed to do okay with them, so that means a lot to me personally.
I think you've done quite well doing it that way. I wouldn't change a thing.
Thanks. I know. I try to think about it sometimes. I'm like, well, what if I had a character down in Seattle? And it's like, I don't know. I don't think that would resonate as real for me.
Yeah,
no. It just wouldn't resonate. It would look a lot like, if I tried that, Seattle would probably look a lot like Vancouver Island all of a sudden. It'd be a lot of rain. It probably wouldn't be that big of a transition, but
yeah. Well, now, for fans that just kind of find out about you and they're hearing this and they're maybe like, who is this Chevy Stevens girl? And what are those books? I love it, those girls. But then they realize that you have, That Night, Always Watching, Never Knowing, Still Missing Out. And they say, hey, after this book that I want to read this one, which of the other four should I start with? Where do you kind of point them to?
Well, like I said, you can read them all, you can read them outside of order, but if you want to be specific, follow my course. Still Missing is the first novel I wrote. That's the one that won the International Thriller of the Year in Best First Novel category. It was a New York Times bestseller. It's sold all over the world. That one is about a realtor who's abducted from an open house and then held captive for a year by a psychopath, and it's about when she was captive and what it's like for her to transition back into her world now. Never Knowing is about a woman, Sarah, who discovers that her birth father is a notorious Canadian serial killer who has never been caught, and he finds out about her and initiates contact. Always Watching is about the therapist who's in the first two novels, and it deals with repressed memories, and she meets a patient who triggers some memories for her of a time that she spent in a commune when she was growing up. And That Night is about Tony Murphy, who, along with her boyfriend, is charged and convicted of murdering her sister, wrongfully convicted. She spends 15 years in prison, and when she and Ryan come out, they need to find out if they can reestablish their relationship and if she can solve who really killed her sister. And then those girls we've spoke about, and then my current one is called, the one I'm working on, is called Not Alone.
Oh, now, are you looking at another fall release probably next year for that? Are you going to be sticking in the rest?
No.
Not really fall.
Well,
summer,
they've all typically...
It's fall now, but you're
all
summer,
they've all typically been summer, but Not Alone will actually come out in winter of 2017. We're going to delay it a little. I got a little bit behind on this one, but also it's putting some... I went off in the wrong direction in the beginning, and I was working one book that was just not happening for me. That happens, even on your sixth book, it can happen. And it became one of those, you know, just beating a dead horse and you just have to abandon it and start fresh. So that's what happened. So it put me a little bit behind, but that's all right. We're going to go out in February, which I'm actually kind of excited about, a change of pace there. My family's excited about it too because it means I'll be around in the summer a little bit more and not so focused on marketing and doing other things. So
right.
We'll see how it goes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just
hey,
show, even six books in, you're still learning.
I think you're always learning. I mean, I was talking with Jeffrey Deaver, and he said the same thing. You know, he learns all the time.
Yeah.
Every time is a different – every time you put "the" on the page, it's you just don't know what's coming after it. And I think that that's wonderful.
Exactly.
So, now, we got about 30 seconds to go, so I want to give you the last word to kind of let everybody know where your social media, all the other fun stuff they can kind of get a hold of you in, and I'm just taking it away.
Great. Okay. I'm on Facebook, Chevy Stevens on Facebook. I'm on there all probably a lot more than I should be, but I love interacting with my fans. I also have a website, www.chevystevens.com, and I do have Twitter, but I'm not such a Twitter kind of girl. Facebook's where it's at for me. So I love saying hi to people, and I post a lot of funny videos, mostly dog orientated. And that's my recreation. Thank you for having me. It was great.
Oh, yeah. And the thing that I found is that, for a lot of women, I've been married 20 years, going on 21. So, you know, 140 characters just is not good for women. They're much better Facebookers than Twitters. Men are better
tweeters. Well, I like comments.
You don't
want
to talk that much.
Yeah, I like interacting, too. Like, I like seeing – it's just the configuration.
Right.
I like seeing all the comments underneath and talking with people and chatting. And, yeah, Twitter just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah, Twitter's tough. Well, hey, Chevy, we want to thank you for coming on. It has been fabulous.
Thank you.
Good luck. We look forward to seeing the next one out. And now we're going to be about another year and a half away. So I don't know how well that's going to fit with people, but, you know, it is what it is.
I know. You're the first person I've actually kind of fit. I haven't really said anything about it elsewhere. I'm afraid of everyone getting mad at me. Trust me, it's going to be worth the wait. That's all I can say.
Yeah, and you know what? And if they're just finding you out by this book, those girls, they still got four more they can go back and read. So they got their
exactly.
All right. Well, you have a good one.
Thank
we will
you.
Talk with you soon and stay good.
You bet. Thanks for the support.
All right. Bye
bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Chevy Stevens, and what a wonderful book that just came out called Those Girls. Came out in July. Go get it right now on Amazon. Pick it up. Print, ebook, however you normally read books. It is available right now. And you can go grab it. We also want to let you know there's a new book out by one of our friends and authors. He just had a very, very horrible week. Shane Yerke, his latest book is called The Fury. It is by Kensington, another wonderful publisher that we like to talk about here. But Shane Yerke and The Fury is his first book out in quite some time. And we want to offer our condolences to Shane, who just lost a terrible battle of cancer that she had. And the book came out September 4th, and Shane is one of those fabulous writers, great guys. I encourage everybody to go check out the book, The Fury, and this is a shout-out to Shane Yerke on that, and make sure that you go look at that and see if that's up your alley and pick it up. And go to Kensington Publishing, kensingtonbooks.com, and check out all the fun things they have, because they do everything from cozies to thrillers to suspense, and they got everything going on. The other thing, a shout-out, is to Midnight Inc. They are Megan Beaumont, our next guest, which is coming up. She is a Midnight Inc. author, and they are 10 years now in existence. And Midnight Inc. put out some wonderful books that we've been able to talk to some of their authors on. And, you know, we wish we could do more coverage with them, but you know, we get so bogged down. We're on pace to get about 10,000 books this year to review. So we don't have a lot of time. We can only read so fast. And to try to get all that in. But we just want to make sure that you try to have the idea, because the publisher is kind of as important as the author. For a publisher, if you're just going to be throwing books out, and here's why I'll tell you that, is that the publisher is pretty important. It is a long process to get a book out, for those who might not know. Like Chevy is working one on now, and it's not going to be out for quite some time, because it does take that long to go through the editing process to make sure you have everything done. And if you have a publisher that does this right, you're going to have a quality book. If you have a publisher that doesn't really do the editing and just looks at the book and says, oh, okay, yeah, that's wonderful, we like the idea, and then they start publishing it, but they didn't really get into it, you're not going to get the quality of work. So you want to make sure that if you find some of your favorite authors, look and see who their publishers are and check them out. Like we said, Midnight Inc., Kensington. Those are a couple ones that are just wonderful, outside, of course, of the big Simon & Schuster's and the Random Houses. We already know all about those. It's the other ones that we need to look at. It's the other publishers that we need to go. We need the support, because there's so many wonderful authors. Check out UK Books. You know, check out all of those. Peter James and Ian Rankin and Mark Bellingham. All those wonderful authors that tell such fabulous stories. I think that a lot of people over here are missing out on those wonderful authors and those great stories, that they're just not getting themselves involved like they should, especially if you're a reader. And I'm just getting, you know, I love audiobooks. I'm going to the library today. I'm going to go pick up a couple, because while I'm sitting there working, I love to be able to put an audiobook and put my headset on and work and listen to it and get involved that way. However the medium is that you want to listen to, I just suggest go out of your comfort zone. If you're a straight thriller reader, go out and read a suspense psychological kind of book. You know, read a mystery, read a whodunit. You know, maybe dabble a little in the horror. You don't have to read the gore stuff. You know, that's not really for me either. But, you know, get involved in those kinds of things and expand yourself as a reader, just like the author has to expand themselves as an author instead of just becoming a brand and writing the same book over and over and over and over again. You know, David Morrell is one of those wonderful authors who never really writes the same book twice, even though now he wrote kind of a series with Murder at the Fine Art and Inspector of the Dead with Thomas DeQuincy. But it's such a thought-provoking character that when we've had him on to talk about, you know, he'll let you know exactly who he is. And these interviews that we do are for you. You know, they're not for me. I can talk to these authors anytime that I want to and get an idea. I want to bring them to you so you have the understanding of not only how difficult the writing is, but the stories that come out of their heads, the characters that they put on the paper, the entertainment that they want to give you, you know, the reader, that they're very in tune with what you want to read. And, you know, and this is for you. They don't write for themselves, otherwise they would not publish it. So we want to bring these readers to you. We want to bring these authors to you. So you have an understanding, so you have much better, well-rounded view of things that you can get involved in and books that you can pick up and read. And you got, you know, three authors here. I mean, we're waiting on Megan to call in. She's more of a darker author, and I don't know if something happened, but I don't know if she's going to make it or not. So I'm gabbing for a little bit until we see if she's going to call in again. But just the different styles that we had with R.J. Dearden and then Chevy Stevens, that's the kind of thing that you're going to get here on this show. And those are the kind of authors you're going to get. We have, you know, I don't know, 300 shows, 1,000 authors that we've interviewed, and many different kinds of things that we've done on here with all the shows that we have with Beyond the Cover and Crime and Science Radio. We'll be back next Saturday. Hank Philippi Ryan interviewed Jan Burke on her own show and Doug Lyle. And those are two separate shows. We're going to do Jan's first, and then Doug's going to be on the 26th of September. And then we have Beyond the Cover with Jeff Ayers and myself, and who we got coming up there. I mean, we've had some, you know, we've had Nelson DeMille on there. We've had Jeffrey Deaver on there. You know, we've had some hard, big-time authors. But we've also had, you know, other authors that you just may be finding out about. We've had James Abel on, you know, the show to talk about. So we've had some very, very interesting people that are coming on that you can hear their stories and understand who they are coming out as an author. And I think that that's wonderful that you're able to do that. And we feel so honored to be able to bring it to you. Again, you know, we don't make any money off of this. I'm telling you, this is a labor of love. I talk to you on my Saturday mornings as a labor of love, just to try to help you out in decision making. Remember, I make no money doing this radio show. This is a totally free thing. In fact, it actually costs me money because I have to pay to have it on the air. And, you know, we do the magazine as a labor of love. You know, these are things that, you know, I have another job. I just want to make sure, do the best that I can to try to help these authors, because it's such a difficult time for them to read, and I want to help you as readers to make better choices or to make other choices on books that you read. So that's about all I got to say about that. It looks like maybe Megan either forgot, or something happened, but we will try to get her on again. But her latest book is called Promises to Keep, and I'll just read you kind of a little bit about what it says. For 3 years, Michael O'Shea has been forced to act as a personal assassin for Livingston Shaw, the cold-blooded puppet master who controls the remote blow upon implanted in Michael's back. When Shaw offers to release him, if he can recover a kidnapped child, Michael works with every ounce of his being to put the pieces together before all the witnesses are murdered. That's something that, if you know, check it out and explore. Check out Megan Beaumont, Promises to Keep, Chevy Stevens, Those Girls, and R.J. Dearden, The Realignment Case. And we hopefully will get Megan on to talk more about her book. But in the meantime, I think we're just going to call the show here. It's been great to be able to speak with you. I want to thank you all again for joining us. Make sure you check out SuspenseRadioNetwork.com to see other things that are coming up. I'm going to update the site as soon as I can to let you guys all know who's coming on and what we have going on with the show. We still have 3 more interviews that we are going to play. Jamie Frevoletti, we have Robert Wilson, and I think we have Hank Philip Ryan to come on there too. I'm not sure exactly who are the 3, but we still have, I believe, have 3 authors left. Some thriller fest for you guys to listen to. And again, we do this, you know, so you can hear them, you can talk to them, you can, and we will see you all on. I'm going to be on here in 2 weeks, and Story Blender is going to be on Friday, and then Saturday is going to be Crime and Science Radio, and Labor Day on Monday we're going to be playing those interviews on Beyond the Cover, so make sure you check that out. I'm a little discombobulated trying to figure out, I didn't know I was going to have to do all this. So until next time, everybody, though, we want to say thank you so much, and keep reading.